Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 25th, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. I probably should announce at the beginning this time, as I didn't last time, that we're pre-recording due to a series of scheduling conflicts, so we will not be able to take your questions live today, but you can always send in questions to radio@larouchepub.com. Now, what we're going to talk about today is the combination of the collapse of state governments, the funding for state and local governments, at a time in which we're seeing, as well, national institutions fail. We're seeing an acceleration of the crisis in Europe. And our regular listeners know that over the last several years, we at LaRouche PAC and LaRouche Show have been covering the acceleration of this economic crisis and how it affects our 50 states. And as the financial collapse has deepened, state and local governments have been stupidly making deeper and deeper cuts. And I say stupidly because, as Lyndon LaRouche has explained repeatedly in webcasts and in written articles, austerity never creates wealth. And cutting spending alone will never lead to growth. The case of California, which I've chronicled quite often, demonstrates this conclusively. Under the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, during his 7-plus years in office, the state budget was cut over $80 billion, and yet there is a new, bigger deficit every single year. Now, as state and local governments are cutting the budgets, at the same time, the situation for the people who live in them gets worse, because you have reductions in police, firings of teachers, closings of schools, and other public workers losing their jobs and getting net pay cuts. So the states are becoming dysfunctional. Also, when you start cutting the services, those who are cut are those who need the help the most: the poor, the sick, the disabled, and the elderly. So we're coming up to the end of the fiscal year next week for most of the state governments. And quite a few of them have not yet passed budgets. Most states have balanced budget requirements. And it's unlikely that a number of them will be able to meet the requirements of balancing their budgets. Now, as I said at the beginning, this is, of course, just another symptom of the global crisis, which is now threatening to go into a chain reaction collapse. Will it be triggered by a Greek default, a failure to bail out Greece? Or perhaps it will be triggered by bailing out Greece, which will just lead to a hyperinflationary explosion. Perhaps a major bank failure or two. Or perhaps the defaults that may be coming among state governments. So on today's program, we're going to discuss this crisis and its implications. And we'll also discuss the mobilization by LaRouche PAC and the LaRouche slate of candidates to reverse the crisis, beginning with the voting up in the Congress of the Glass-Steagall Bill, H.R. 1489, which gained some momentum in the last couple of days and is now up to 19 co-sponsors. So joining me on today's program to discuss this will be Paul Gallagher from the Executive Intelligence Review and Diane Sayre, a Democratic candidate for Congress in New Jersey and one of the 6 members of the LaRouche candidate slate. But first, I want to bring in my co-host for the LaRouche Show, Marcia Mary Baker, who has been following very closely in the last days the state budget crisis and was in a discussion with Lyndon LaRouche on this, I believe, yesterday. Marcia, why don't you just fill us in on where we stand with state crises?
Right, Harley. And so what the best thing I can do is give some features of the situation as we go into the new fiscal year for about 46 of the states next Friday. That would be July 1st. And you can let your imagination figure if any aspect of this is going to be the lit fuse for chain reactions of unpayability, that it will just go wild in this exploding financial system anyway. Now, about 20 to 21 of the 46 states which begin a new fiscal year July 1st, don't have their budgets approved. And that's not That something like that happened in the last few years as the crash came about, and some of these are finishing up today or tomorrow. Even those that proclaim how wonderful it is that they created a budget, such as Michigan. On Tuesday, Governor Rick Snyder signed a budget. It's awful. They have one. And we can come around to that. They made all the kinds of cuts you've just been describing, and so it's an unlivability budget. But in any case, of those 20 states, some are very prominent. You mentioned California, and Pennsylvania is another one. Diane will be talking about New Jersey, I am very sure. And you have, but basically, all of these 40-some states that do or don't have a budget for their new year, they have about $103 billion, it's calculated, in a gap between their expected revenue and what they currently expect to spend. In other words, they've been cutting everywhere or haggling over what to cut. So that's a linear projection that there would be a shortfall or what you could call a deficit.
So, Marcia, what you're saying then is that by the end of this next week, they still have to figure out how to either raise $103 billion among them or cut $103 billion.
Yes, that's the kind of thing. And for some of them, their gap as a percent of their actual general fund budget spending is over 20 some percent. That includes California, Nevada, Texas. Many states are certainly over 10%. The situation is impossible. Mr. LaRouche, and looking at just what we said yesterday, said, okay, it's the end of the line. Call it the end of the trolley line. It's the last stop. You can't continue this, and it's unconstitutional in the sense that states, except for, I think, Vermont, Harley, by law, have to, by their state law, they can't print money. They can't just fake it. They have to have some kind of balance or pretense of it. They can't even come up with a pretense right now.
And
Now,
Marcia, just on that as well, I know from the state of California, what's happened in recent years is that the way they've reached a balanced budget is through various forms of trickery, which includes, in some cases, they get an approval for short-term borrowing, which of course means they're really not balanced. They put costs into the next year. They push expenses onto the local governments, and they count some things as fees instead of taxes. And in the case of California, even doing all those things, they still were rather without a budget for 3 months last year and ended up, you may remember, giving out IOUs to state workers. So what I know what Mr. LaRouche said is that it's the last trolley stop, but he also said they have a little wiggle room if they do things which are essentially illegal.
gimmicks.
Gimmicks, yeah.
Yeah, Pennsylvania last year didn't have a budget for maybe up to 2 months. And to give a sense of this, well, take Illinois. You know, they are coming. I think Pat Quinn, the governor, has not signed it, but they have, the legislature's provided a budget, but over $1 billion of that in unpaid bills are put off till 2013. In other words, just put off for a year. They're just going to delay paying, including
And
delaying.
some of this is payment to contractors who have already done work for the state and infrastructure, transportation, and things of that sort.
That's right. Even funeral homes that took care of burying the poor and the indigent, whereas the state of Virginia, that proclaims itself so successful in balancing a budget, they cut out paying funeral homes. They're going to throw people in a ditch. I mean, this thing is a mess.
Well, also you have with the Medicaid cuts. And you have some doctors in states who are no longer taking Medicaid patients because they, instead of having to wait 90 days, are now being told they have to wait 180 days or almost half a year to get reimbursed by the state.
Well, that's where let's look at two more features about it, because Medicaid is for some states the largest expenditure out of their general fund, and it's augmented by federal monies. So that if you take a state budget, it in the recent past, on average, 25% of the state budget went to Medicaid, another 25% went to lower and higher education, and then you go on from there with for other kinds of things. But in some states, Medicaid is near 40% of their spending, and it's because more people are poor, more people qualify, even if you try and keep them off the enrollment. And yeah. So this July 1st marks a point where the coincidence of the federal government under Obamacare implementing various kinds of new formulae for paying states less into helping on Medicaid, combined with the states having less. By the way, the states together this year have cut, they're spending less than they did before 2008. You know, I mean, we've just talked about the cuts.
Yeah.
So you have a killer situation, including that most of what states spend when they have been spending it is on the elderly poor in nursing homes. They may not even see a doctor, but they're kept alive by nurses. This is set to be cut in a wholesale way. So you have that. And one other thing to just mention, not just Medicaid, June 30th is when certain federal flows that have gone into the states end with a bang.
The so-called stimulus fund.
That's it. The so-called American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which pumped in about $150 billion in the last 3 years, 60-some billion 1 year and so forth. Now it's gone down. There might still be $6 billion of a certain kind. Other things are ending. I think HIV/AIDS small and large programs are ending. Also, there was an extra $10 billion into states called enhanced Medicaid payments just from January till June 30th this year under that stimulus act. Everything is ending. So, and maybe the
final... except for one thing, Obamacare is not ending, and that's going to be driving costs up.
That's right. And maybe I was just going to say one final feature might dramatize it for people. The Washington and the Obama administration in collusion with Congress is keeping intact that if you're a state hit by disaster, and name one that isn't now, whether it's floods, tornadoes, drought, what's still standing is the general practice where your county, your state has to pay 25% of any rebuilding of any bridge or school or sewer or anything. Or a farmer, 25%. In recent past, the government would pay 75%. But you can't, if you're underwater in Minot, North Dakota, you certainly aren't going to have any means to pay 25%. And so counties, hundreds and hundreds of counties, especially in lower Mississippi and Louisiana and elsewhere, they're all asking, please waive that. Let's have the federal government pay 100% of rebuilding. And Washington isn't paying anything. So I'm just underscoring that you've got this early period of July where also states, budget officers and others are supposed to reconcile accounts. I mean, you're talking, California might be famous for flimflam, but it could be several other states. Whether it's Hawaii, Rhode Island, they're all trying to finalize budgets. It's beyond a pretense of being able to get through this.
Well, Marcia, I think the one bit of disaster relief the nation could use more than anything else would be relief from President Obama by having the 25th Amendment adopted and get him out of office. So thank you very much for this report. Are you going to be writing this for an article?
EIR Online next week will have this, including some of the and I think that you're going to hear about Chris Christie in New Jersey making himself king of the king of the
That's
destruction.
Exactly where I was about
okay.
to go. So thank you very much, Marcia, and talk to you soon. Diane, let's pick up from there. You've been listening to Marcia's report. Of course, what we've seen around the country in states like Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, and New Jersey, where the anti-Obama reaction in November 2010 gave us these crazed austerity governors, Republican governors, who have been blaming the financial crisis on those overpaid teachers and firefighters and basically unionized workers. And we've seen in the last days something in New Jersey, which I don't think anybody would have ever expected, but of course, Wisconsin and Michigan used to be labor states also. So why don't you catch us up on this incredible battle where in New Jersey, as in Wisconsin, the population is not going to lie down and take it.
Okay, well, it's interesting because, of course, New Jersey, Christie came in 2009, and you might say Obama campaigned for him by coming in and making at least 5 appearances for Corzine or with Corzine, but he and Christie seem to do a lot together. Anyway, I mean, there's a couple of things that really stand out in terms of Christie's outrageous actions. One, I still feel like we should double check on this Medicaid thing because I read about it on a Democratic Party newsletter and then I saw the same figure on the front page of the newspapers, which he's lowered the income for a family of 3 to be eligible to receive Medicaid. It used to be $24,000. Apparently, it's now, according to this paper and this, and it just seems so unbelievable, it's $5,000. And he says he's going to save $300 million this way. I mean, I guess you have to be homeless to even qualify, and then there's no way to I mean, it's just in-your-face, obnoxiously unbelievable.
Well, it's genocide. I mean, we should actually say what it is, because when you reduce it that way, that means many working families that are poor are not going to be able to get health care at all.
Right. Right. Exactly. The other thing that he tried to do is to cut over $1 billion out of public education, and he got into a big fight with the New Jersey Supreme Court over this because it was unconstitutional under the state constitution to gouge the public school system by so much. So they ruled, and he was very arrogant. He said he didn't have to abide by state laws. And then he lost and has to come up with another $500 million for the school. So it's been just egregious and in your face. Now, what really has blown up over the last several weeks, and it's a good wake-up call to labor and to the FDR faction of the Democratic Party and patriots, because what occurred is you had a deal made in New Jersey, although we have a Republican governor, the majority of both houses is still Democrats. And so what Christie had to do was to get Democratic support for his so-called pension reform and health care reform. And my understanding from talking to some of the labor guys is they said, well, it's legitimate if the state, if the legislature wants to be involved in the pension reform because the state has to make matching payments into the pension fund. So they have a legitimate interest in this. In terms of the health care plans, the state legislature has never been involved. It's a collective bargaining issue within the unions. And what was done is they just passed a decision which is going to massively increase the amount of money taken out of the public employees' salaries, about 750,000 people, the amount of money taken out of their salaries to pay for their health insurance. And the thing that was the most egregious is that it's an attack on collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that Christie got the president of the Senate, Stephen Sweeney, who is in the Iron Workers Union and who is a Democrat, to go along with his attack on organized labor and abolishing collective bargaining when it comes to health care.
So, Diane, what that means then is that the state will make a unilateral decision now without giving labor an opportunity to present an alternative proposal.
Correct.
Okay. So this is, it's not total collective bargaining, but in a sense what it's saying is the unions have no say in the matter.
Right, exactly. And the unions had made an offer, and I forget all the details, but it was quite a substantial. The state would have saved a lot of money with the offer from the unions. So they're, you know, the unions correctly perceive this simply as an attack on them per se. And what happened in the House is, again, you have a Democratic leader, the Speaker of the House, Sheila Oliver, who was in on the deal to recruit enough Democrats to go along with Christie's plan, and that succeeded. Finally, last night, they rammed it through, although I mean, the protest was quite something, and I'm happy to see Labor, as listeners probably know, the New Jersey State AFL-CIO a couple of weeks ago passed a resolution voicing their support for Marcy Kaptur's H.R. 1489, the return to Glass-Steagall.
Well, Diane, give us a little sense of the labor mobilization, because from what I understand, this became, when Christie came into office thumbing his nose at labor and saying, I don't care what you think you want, we can't afford any of it. And so he, in a sense, was throwing out the collective bargaining agreements from the beginning. But we're seeing a real response with the Glass-Steagall resolution, and now you were on the scene, I guess, yesterday in Trenton. Give us a report on what happened there.
Well, the last week has been very exciting, because starting last Thursday, they began sort of a week of action, of protests. And last Thursday, I was there. A bunch of people of our organizers were down there. They had about 5,000 people. It was police, firefighters, teachers, and communication workers. And the response was very open. A lot of them already know us. I've addressed various county central labor council organizations. We've met with the firefighters and police because of the fights in the city councils where they're cutting them. I think the state has fired a total of 3,400 police officers so far in different cities. So the thing that was striking to organizers on Thursday was that only out of the thousands of people we saw, there were maybe two people who objected to the mustache on Obama. And this is a definite shift. And I think the shift is occurring because they're watching the Democratic leadership of the state sell out, and it's not that far of a stretch to think of Obama, you know, completely selling out and not being what people had hoped he would be in terms of representing their voice.
In fact, wasn't there a funeral procession for the old Democratic Party in yesterday?
Yes, that was yesterday. What happened Monday, and again indicating their thinking, is they got American Revolutionary War reenactors, because it's the Delaware and the Battle of Trenton. So on Monday, they had a march across the Delaware River into Trenton, led by costumed professional Revolutionary War heroes to Trenton. And then on yesterday, which was the final showdown, what happened, I was there early in the morning, and the vote was supposed to be at 1 o'clock. By 9:30 a.m., there were already 2,500 or so people milling around outside, and then I heard rumors there was going to be a funeral procession. Someone had looked out the window and seen a coffin, and so at 11 a.m., about 1,000 people marching behind a Dixieland band with, you know, the tuba, trombone, trumpet, banjo, everything, a large black hearse, and the sign on the hearse said, the soul of the Democratic Party. They were burying, the soul of the Democratic Party had died. And then they had a banner, which the people behind in the funeral procession were saying, the death of the Democratic Party as we have known it.
Well, I think and I'll come back to you in a few minutes, Diane. I want to bring Paul Gallagher in for a moment, but I want to just make sure people realize this is the LaRouche Show. This is the program for Saturday, June 25th, 2011. And we're talking about both the escalating financial and economic crisis, but also the political crisis. And Paul, I know you're up on Capitol Hill today, and there are a lot of things happening. There was the Libya vote, and there was a supposedly pro and anti-Obama vote on that. But what we're seeing, what Diane reported about the shift in the Democratic Party, with a certain grouping in the leadership defending Obama and sticking with the bailout, sticking with the budget cuts against the traditional interests of the Democratic Party. That's sort of reflected in what we're seeing now in the motion toward the Glass-Steagall, but also, interestingly, one of the new co-signers yesterday, co-sponsors, Representative Kaufman from Colorado, is a Republican who tends toward the Tea Party side of things. So, Paul, how do you see this whole bigger fight shaping out in Washington right now?
Well, it's Very much as you say that the, you know, these people who, the members of Congress, have become more and more clearly aware of the tremendous ferment of their constituents and the tremendous dissatisfaction and anger of their constituents. This is going back more than a year and a half now. It's been building up, but they're really aware of it now. And it's for a certain number of them, they're beginning to realize that this is significantly taking the shape of wanting to bring the banks and Wall Street under control by Glass-Steagall. The resolutions, the demands for Glass-Steagall from major labor unions is invaluable in this, because it's a real reality shock. I saw it in the face of one Democratic member from Massachusetts that I was talking to this morning, who himself, despite a lot of strange ideas about banks and so on and so forth, and what Glass-Steagall doesn't do, he comes out of the iron workers union himself. This really crystallized what it is, in a shocking way for him, what it is that is being demanded of the Congress by the furious American population, which sees the economy crashing down on them in an accelerating way for the second time in 3 years. And so it's a matter now, you know, conceivably you could go linearly from 20 sponsors to 400 sponsors over much too long a period of time. It's a matter now of the getting the thing into the Senate and getting more leaders in the House at the level of, for example, Louise Slaughter of New York, getting more committee and caucus leaders in the House to sponsor Glass-Steagall, and then people will come onto it in chunks, in groups, in bunches. But the pressure, they realize the pressure is already on them. And anywhere we go, we can put it on them. We've pretty much pushed the 20 supporters, the 20 sponsors of it so far in the House. We've pretty much pushed them personally into doing it.
Paul, one of the things that Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing is this question of reality hitting. That it's one thing for the Bureau of Labor Statistics to put out these dummied up reports on employment and basically lying about it, and for the president to come out and say, look, the recovery's going, it's just not getting enough jobs yet, we're working on it. Bernanke gave a similar speech to that effect this weekend, or this last week. But I think what's happening is that the reality of the continuing collapse in employment, with the inflation, price inflation in food and gasoline, people begin to realize that even if they're working, they're losing ground. The housing foreclosures, the price drops in housing, all across the board, even the talking heads on television are now admitting, gee, it's not going as it is. I assume this is not being missed by people in the Congress, from both hearing it from their constituents and also they're not all immoral idiots. They must be seeing this thing coming down on their heads.
No, they're not. But they are. They are without a policy. And the really vital thing here is that Glass-Steagall is taking on the aspect of a national policy, a national economic policy, before it's too late and the economy completely collapses, to reverse this thing. Because they're quite aware that they have no such policy, and Glass-Steagall becomes that. The substantial endorsements from among the population constituency organizations are making it become that, and that's really what's crucial about it. You mentioned Bernanke; these people are really discredited now. Nobody pays any attention to what the Bureau of Labor Statistics claims once a month anymore. And people are now calling Bernanke a liar just because of his speech yesterday, his press conference yesterday, because he gave a big press conference 2 months ago. That was his first, you know, the new slick.
That was the first press conference, I think, ever
given by the Federal Reserve Chairman. The new incredibly slick Fed chairman, now gives press conferences. In his first one, he didn't mention oil. In his second one, only 2 months later, all of a sudden, he discovered that the price of oil, gasoline, had become a significant factor in, quote, slowing down the U.S. economy. And the next day, by the machinations of the Obama administration, there was an international announcement of 60 million barrels of oil being released from various strategic reserves. Voila, QE3 in the form of oil, right? The price of oil fell dramatically. The price of the yields on bonds, government bonds, fell dramatically as this was announced. And everybody, it was just a sign of panic that they would try to use drastic cuts in the price of oil as a QE3, because Bernanke doesn't have the votes for QE3 in the Fed anymore. So this is real panic, and Bernanke really put a big hole in his credibility, what's left of it, with thing yesterday.
Bernanke's policy had been the bailout with Geithner and Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and as Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing, the arrest of Strauss-Kahn was a major blow to the attempt at doing bailouts. I'm just curious, from the discussions you're having on Capitol Hill, how big an effect is the ongoing kabuki theater in Europe over to bail out or not bail out with Greece and Portugal and so on? How big effect does that have on the thinking of people in the Congress?
There's been a lot of blindness to that, except among those who really go after the Federal Reserve until recently. Everybody in Congress who watches the Federal Reserve knows now that its biggest bailouts went to European banks and are still going to European banks. And I mean, look, Sheila Bair, who's retiring as head of the FDIC, she just put the figure, and this is now one of the three individuals who were in charge of the bailout, in effect. She put the figure at north of $14 trillion. That was the capabilities, as she said it, the announced capacities of the bailout programs of the FDIC, the Treasury, and the Federal Reserve. $14, $15 trillion. Some members of Congress now know that most of this went to European banks and Cayman Islands, hedge funds, and so on and so forth. So there's alertness to this. Now that the Greek, Italy, and other things are exploding, and you know, Greece is proof positive that what the states are now doing doesn't work. What the federal states here in the United States are doing doesn't work. You cut, you cut, you cut in Greece, and a year later, you have a bigger debt ratio to GDP. You have a bigger budget deficit than you had before. You have much less revenue and economic, and so you're in a death spiral, and you're headed downward. Yeah. And that's what has happened to Greece. Now, yesterday, the Italian banks, all of a sudden, the big Italian banks were all downgraded. There's began to be a stock panic around the Italian banks. Mm-hmm. And this morning, I was in there looking to Shanghai people and talked to them about Glass-Steagall. I went to a hearing of one of the committees dealing with the fact that the money market funds, in which, you know, millions and millions of Americans have put their what money they have to have access to it, but also earn a little pittance of interest. These money market funds, which amount to maybe $2.5 trillion or so total, $1 trillion of that is in loans to European banks.
Wow.
So, you know, buying the bonds of various kinds of these European banks, which are all, the credit of these European banks is all deteriorating.
You know, Paul, this is actually interesting, because one of the lines that we're getting against Glass-Steagall is that even union pension funds, 401ks, money market, mutual funds are all invested in various pools that include mortgage-backed securities, but also European bank funds, European government bonds, and so on. And so if we have a Glass-Steagall, that will cut the income or the prospective pensions of people who've put money in there. So, you know, it's clear that this is a line that's going out to try to take people who should be supporting Glass-Steagall and cause them to hold back. Did you run into that at all in this hearing?
Yes, it's populism, and you know the form that populism takes among congressmen is, if 15 of my constituents have buy derivatives, then I must say derivatives are good, right? if 25 of my constituents have money market funds, then whatever the money market funds want to do, I have to defend it. That's just populism. And some of them were shocked at this hearing today, the more intelligent ones, because the witnesses were all representatives of the mutual fund industry, with one exception, or academics, you know, bankrolled by them. And what they came and said is, yeah, there's some systemic risk here in these money market funds, but don't regulate it. Don't declare money market funds to be, the word is SIFI, systemically important financial institute. Don't declare them to be that, because then they'd have to be regulated more and so on and so forth. What they need is set up a liquidity bank for them and give it access to the Federal Reserve discount window as if it were a commercial bank. So
in other words, let them participate in the bailout.
Give us a bailout. Give us a government guarantee. No regulations, mind you. No regulations of any kind. But this was essentially the mutual fund industry saying, well, at least this $3 trillion part of our industry now, we need a bailout. And this was a shock to, in other words, they were saying, you better have a bailout ready because this could go again. And this was a shock to the more intelligent congressmen. So the European thing is coming through to them in that sense, even though they're all, you know, desperate to say we love money market accounts because of our constituents. So it's coming through in a lot of ways, but that $14 trillion, I mean, look, the Federal Reserve could be buying, it could be directly the means of supporting the states right now. It's legal.
Instead of pouring money into defending these worthless assets on the books of the banks.
Exactly. $1.5 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities that are still owned by the Federal Reserve, illegal under Glass-Steagall that it should have those, including the way it got them. Get rid of them. They are allowed to purchase municipal bonds, which means generally city and state bonds. They, you know, you can force the Fed through a Glass-Steagall reorganization to function as a national bank and to support the states and the municipalities who have actually laid off 450,000 public employees since 2007.
Well, Diane, you've been organizing some of those public employees who have been cut off, laid off in cities such as Camden, New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey. When we were talking with Mr. LaRouche yesterday, he was discussing how people are looking for understandable solutions, but they still have this pessimism because they believe in the second law of thermodynamics. They don't believe that there's a higher organization and process carried out by human activity. And so as a result, a lot of people just accept it. But I think what we're seeing now is people beginning to question everything, including possibly the second law of thermodynamics. What are you seeing among policemen and firefighters and these union people you're talking to? Are they beginning to get the bigger picture?
Yeah, they're definitely, for one, they're deciding that they actually have to fight and not sit on the sidelines, which is already a shift. The other is, one of the meetings I did was probably typical. It was with the head of a police organization, and he said, look, I know all about this. I saw the inside job. Did you see the inside job? He'd seen, you know, this movie about all this corruption, and he said, so I'm with you. I get it. But my guys just are not going to understand that they have about a 4-minute attention span, so when you talk to them, don't go through all this. But happily he underestimated them, because when I showed up to meet with him the first time, his assistant, who I don't know if he considers him one of the guys, says, oh, I saw you. You spoke at the city council meeting about that banking act. What's the name of it? So they're actually really closely following it. And then there was someone in the firemen's union, the firefighters union, who has his own website, and he actually posted a petition to get people to sign on to support Marcy Kaptur's bill.
So you know, the Firefighters International president was the one who came out and said, we're turning off the spigot of union funds to the Democrats and to Obama precisely because of Obama's tacit support for what Governor Walker was doing in Wisconsin. And now clearly, you know, what he's doing with his obese twin in New Jersey, Christie.
Yeah.
Diane, you also had an event this week, I believe, in Pennsylvania, which was quite interesting, again, in terms of people grabbing on to Glass-Steagall as a lifeline. Can you give a report on that?
Sure. I mean, this was, frankly, somewhat surprising because I had the Machinist Union was meeting, or Machinist Council, the statewide Machinist Council, was meeting in York, which is not that far from Harrisburg. And so I thought I would go because I'd spoken with a couple of them by phone and emailed them the resolutions that have been passed in New Jersey, the International Machinist endorsement of H.R. 1489. And they had said that they would bring it up. So I thought I would just stop in and see if I could meet the people I'd been in touch with. And somewhat to my surprise, they said, look, why don't we see if we can get you on and have you address the body of about 200 machinists. And that's what occurred. And again, they were very attentive and very sharp. And it was somewhat humorous because the speaker before me was going through this kind of, I mean, really goofy Keynesian thing about supply and demand, and you know, the reason we're in a mess is because rich people don't pay enough taxes, and everybody in the room knew that it was nonsense. And one of the guys finally yelled out, "What about the fascist capitalist free trade system?" and so the speaker had to say, "Well, I guess participation from the audience will help to make it more interesting. So feel free." you know, again, so people, and now it's life and death. So people have decided they do have to know this. And when I was speaking, I noticed people were very attentive. When I went through what happened to Dominique Strauss-Kahn, that this was a phase shift in the situation signaling the end of the bailout policy. They were also very interested in what was happening in New Jersey with these layoffs. When I said that Newark has had a 70% increase in homicides, people were gasped. And then that this, in effect, what we're saying, Glass-Steagall, you could charge back the debt. You could charge back maybe $17 trillion of this insane toxic debt to Wall Street. And everybody just burst into applause. And then I did just get today a copy of their resolution, also supporting H.R. 1489. And it's a very strong resolution. It cites the New Jersey, it's modeled on the New Jersey one. It references that the national AFL-CIO is supporting this legislation and the International Machinist Union is supporting this legislation, and therefore they're signing on, and they want a copy of their resolution to go to every single member of the Pennsylvania congressional delegation.
Good, and these are, there are on the website, the LaRouchePac.com website, we have I believe there's some video of you from the Trenton rally yesterday, and these we have a Glass-Steagall page that you can go to. And those of you listening to this program, look, we're in the period, these next weeks and months, where Lyndon LaRouche has said it's unlikely we can make it through the summer. We're in a period of inflection points, is what he told us yesterday, where these are not a sequence of events. But any one of these situations, for example, a default from Greece or the effect of the state budget crises in the first 2 weeks of July, any one of these things could trigger us into a new pathway of a rapidly accelerated chain reaction collapse. And so we don't have a lot of time on this Glass-Steagall. We're getting some momentum, and we need to really move with it. And Diane, what you and the other six candidates, or other five candidates, are doing is providing a sense of leadership. And what are the plans over the next immediate period? I know there have been a lot of town meetings. There's going to be one with Keisha Rogers today, in fact, in Houston. I was in Salt Lake City this week. We had them in Seattle, San Francisco. You've had some. They've been in Boston. What do you think people should do who are listening to the program to get some of these other 400 congressmen on board?
Well, there's a lot of things they can do. We got a report this morning from Summer's campaign in San Francisco about the people that they're meeting who are signing up, you know, right in the street. They're getting back to them, and they had a delegation of 10 people who went to Nancy Pelosi's office. And Pelosi knows that her policies are so detestable, you can't even apparently go into her office. So an aide had to come out and meet with them. But this kind of thing is extremely effective for people to go, take your friends and neighbors, go to the congressman's office. The other thing is apparently these official institutions endorsing H.R. 1489 and putting things out on their official stationery and letterhead are very effective. And I know in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and elsewhere, we've had a large number of our just activist networks go into their city council, read the resolution that's on the LaRouche PAC website, bring in some of the other resolutions, and we've gotten a number of city councils who have passed resolutions, and that also definitely adds weight for these congressmen in their congressional districts. So that's one of the things that we were discussing among the six of us, is broadening the base that actually thousands of Americans can take leadership in this way and go to their city council, their labor organization, their whatever, and get something done on this Glass-Steagall and then feed it back into the Congress.
Well, you were telling us earlier you have a very good new development on this. Why don't you go through that?
You mean the Pennsylvania machinist?
Yeah.
Which I was just discussing. That was what Harley was asking about, the machinist union, which they just passed. There's also some motion in one of our states where I think we're going to be getting, and one of these states, although I'm officially a candidate in New Jersey, I've sort of decided that I have to be responsible for New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And we've been meeting with legislators in all these states, and it looks like there may be a letter released from one group of them, which will be sent to the whole congressional delegation. And they're quite excited about it. They're collaborating. The person initiating it told me they have a substantial or an impressive number of co-signers.
Uh-huh.
They were stymied at getting something through the legislature as a whole, so they've gotten a little caucus of them, and we should have that actually, I'm hoping, by Monday.
Great.
Good. Now, Paul, what I'd like to do, we have just a little less than 15 minutes, but one of the things I'd like to get at is this higher question. It's clear we've got to do something. We've got to break the cycle of bailouts and budget cuts. And as I presented at the beginning, I think you weren't able to hear it, but that what LaRouche has repeatedly emphasized, and I think you also restated it a few minutes ago, austerity never creates wealth. And cutting budgets, cutting spending, never by itself leads to growth. And that's why the Glass-Steagall bill that we're talking about, Franklin Roosevelt's bill, is not merely a piece of legislation, but it reflects a higher principle, a principle of credit, a way of directing the resources of a population towards producing future wealth as opposed to managing debt. And I wonder if you can just say a couple things about that, because I know you've written about this, and this is partly what you're ending up discussing in Capitol Hill, because at a certain point the nuts and bolts of legislation is not enough. People really have to understand there's a higher principle involved.
Yeah, that's right. Just by reading the Glass-Steagall legislation, it doesn't immediately become apparent unless you have understood what Franklin Roosevelt's administration did with that, for example. It doesn't immediately become apparent until it's thought through that this is an economic policy. Maybe a good place to start is one economist made an image several years ago, which struck me very much, a couple of years ago, I guess, that this collapse since LaRouche announced that it was about to, that the global monetary system was going to collapse in July of 07, that's now 4 years ago, it went through the phase of debt blowout and international bank panic, worldwide bank panic, like through the first wall of a hurricane. And then it passed, it seemed to pass into a relatively quiet period, very much like the eye of a hurricane, which was produced by huge bailout. I mean, we know the United States alone, $15, $17 trillion, unimaginably huge bailout liquidity provided by governments from taxpayer funds. And now it has hit the second wall, the other wall of the hurricane, which is the collapse of the governments, which completely dedicated their credit and revenues to those bailouts, even as their revenues were plunging as a result of the collapse in economic activity. They redirected what there was of it into this bailout, and now we've hit the disintegration of those governments, which rebounds back on the banks and causes potentially another worldwide bank panic in the course of this wave of the collapse. So our states in the United States are in a situation like that, very similar to the countries that are in crisis in the European Union or in the whole European, transatlantic area. Our states are in that situation, and that puts us, with Glass-Steagall to a certain extent, in the situation of Hamilton, who had to create this country constitutionally by creating a credit policy which was capable of restoring the credit of the states and establishing the credit of the United States and directing that credit into the real creation of wealth, which means the creation of productivity.
Paul, it's important in bringing up the Hamilton question in pointing out that he was facing a situation of huge debt accumulated during the Revolutionary War. So he was in a somewhat similar situation where, fortunately, Hamilton wasn't a Paul Ryan type or a Friedrich von Hayek type saying, you've got to do something about the debt by cutting spending, but actually created a credit system with the Constitution so that we were able to actually pay off the debt through future production.
Mm-hmm. And this is the crucial thing to understand here is that by taking this approach and, as Ms. Baer put it, exceeding $14 trillion worth of announced capabilities of the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and the FDIC, announced capabilities dedicated to Wall Street, and as we know now, dedicated to European banks, London banks, and so forth, cancel those capabilities. Whether they're currently, whether the money is currently loaned out or not is immaterial. The capability, that is the credit of the United States, is gone. It is dedicated to Wall Street, City of London, and here this morning I was hearing the money market fund industry saying, get another $3 trillion of it ready for us because we're coming down the line. So it is dedicated. And until with Glass-Steagall, you completely end that. And you say it doesn't go to that. And if the Fed has $1.5 trillion in mortgage-backed securities, no, it doesn't go to that. We want that money back. The Fed has to use that credit for the purposes of restoring the states and for the purposes of investing in public works of high technology infrastructure like NWAPA. And then you there you have an economic policy, and it's like the challenge that Hamilton faced when he said, unlike all these Republican ideologues, he said the government is not going to default. Even those state governments which have defaulted, we are going to reverse that default. We're going to establish their good faith and credit, and we're going to use by using that credit to increase creativity and productivity. And it was fantastically successful, as these people could not deny. So it seems to me that that's what the Glass-Steagall, or as we've learned now, it's Glass-Steagall, it was Henry Steagall, that's what the Glass-Steagall policy really is.
Well, and Diane, you are running in an area which includes Paterson, New Jersey, which was one of the centers of Hamilton's manufacturing project. And apparently you run into some people there who know something about Hamilton, but I assume your campaign is increasing the knowledge of people in that area of this question of credit.
Yes, it is. And I was just thinking how silly, because the popular opinion is that everyone thinks of the economy in terms of a pie, and there's a limited amount, and if you get more, someone else gets less. And that's really the way that people have been turned against each other, who are all being crushed simultaneously, because they all think that if they're getting less, then the other guy is getting more, when actually the more, the big chunk of it is going to these speculators, going to these European banks, and so on. Whereas what Hamilton was very clear about is that the actual value is determined by the future, which is where you're going to be 50 years from now, 100 years from now, and that determines the value of your actions in the present. So you're not dealing with your particular piece of the pie in the present day at all. And that's the trick, is to get people to kind of open up and actually think in those terms. And I know Keisha, with the work on the space program there, it's interesting. You look at the best leaders in our history, Hamilton, Franklin Roosevelt, Kennedy. It's very clear that their actions, Abraham Lincoln, are determined by their sense of what the future of the nation will be. And they have real leadership.
And I think this is why I would just put in a plug here for the LaRouche Pack website, where the younger people who are doing work with Lyndon LaRouche in the basement and are doing work on the frontiers of science, both in terms of how we have to protect ourselves from the dangers in the present galactic period, but also how advances in scientific discovering new physical principles enable us to not just protect ourselves, but actually increase the physical wealth that's available to sustain a growing population. And these are the kinds of ideas that are lacking in the debate. I mean, Paul, you must at some point just be wringing your hands in frustration when you hear this idiocy about the debt ceiling and that everything's being focused on that. It's actually a big diversion.
I think you brought up before, and I did also, the Greece example has to be thrown at people who stupidly bring this up. This has been tried in the last 2 years. It's completely failed, and it's also completely failed on the level of your own states. California being the by far the clearest example, which have done what you're now trying to do on the federal level, and the result has been utter disaster fiscally and financially, and they're going to start defaulting. These states are going to start defaulting on their bonded debt and everything else. So, it's pretty clear. Harley, maybe you want to mention also, I know very little about this, but you're about to go to Europe for a very important event in this mobilization.
Well, there's an extremely important event coming up the 4th of July weekend, and Lyndon LaRouche will be present. His wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, will be there. And there's been a number of confirmations of significant people from around the world who have been engaged in the recent period, and some people longer, with Lyndon LaRouche on how to break free of this imperial system, this the Anglo-Venetian imperial system, how to use Glass-Steagall to break the back of the Inter-Alpha group and the policy forces that are controlling things, and reestablishing in Europe sovereign nation states, junk the euro. You know, the idea that Greece leaving the euro would be a great tragedy. In fact, if that triggered a number of other states leaving the euro, it might be the way to avoid a Greek tragedy. So there'll be a conference in Germany next weekend, and we'll be getting reports on that on the website, which will include, as I said, a number of collaborators from around the world. But its central feature will be Lyndon LaRouche's personal intervention, direct intervention, at a moment of profound and deepening crisis. And I'd like to thank you, Paul, for being with us today. And Diane, we're doing some quite interesting work. We're in the middle of things everywhere, and nowhere is it more apparent than the work in New Jersey right now. So we'll have you back again as the campaign develops. So you've been listening to The LaRouche Show. We'll be back next weekend with the July 4th special edition, which will be feature Nancy Spanis, who's written extensively on the American system, the editor-in-chief of the Executive Intelligence Review. So thank you again, and we'll be with you next week.